Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Color Your Life Happy for Monday, October 25th, 2010. I'm your host, Flora Brown, coming to you live from Anaheim, California. Our show today will inform, inspire, and encourage you. And in a moment, we will begin today's episode, The Role of Emotional Intelligence to Happiness, with my guest, Dr. Izzy Justice. But first, I'd like to welcome all of you, my listeners. I am so honored that you made space in your schedule to join us. I realize you have lots of other things to do with your time, but I'm glad you chose to spend some of it with us. Now, if you are listening live, I encourage you to participate by asking questions or adding comments. You may do that two ways. If you're on the phone lines, press #1 to let me know you have a question or a comment. If you're over there in the web chat, you just type in your questions or your comments, and I'll be able to see them, and then I could read them on the air. Now, many of you are listening to the recorded version of this show, and I want to thank you and welcome you as well. Regardless of how you access the show, if you enjoy it, please don't keep it a secret. On my show page at blogtalkradio.com/Flora Brown, you can follow me on Twitter, of course, on Facebook. You can click the like button, and those are over there on the radio show page also. But most important, when you're on my radio show page, add yourself as a friend of my show. Now, I know that many of you have your own businesses, so before we move on, I want to tell you about the business tool I use to help me discover my ideal client. The Ideal Client Action Guide helped me realize that trying to be everything to everybody is like using a BB gun to hit a bullseye. By working through the activities, though, that came with the program and the guidance of the audio recording, I was able to take the guesswork out of my marketing, and so can you at www.idealclientactionguide.com. If you are ready to grow your business, add more clients, and enjoy the increased profits you deserve, then tailoring your marketing to your ideal client is the key to your success. So do what I did. Get your copy of the guide today at www.ideal, that's spelled I-D-E-A-L, clientactionguide.com. Again, for those of you who don't know me, I'm Flora Brown, author, coach, and inspirational speaker. I invite you to visit my website, coloryourlifehappy.com, where you can sign up for life coaching if you're ready to make that U-turn in your life, that Y-O-U-turn. I'm also now booking personal appearances for 2011, so if you'd like to have me appear in person to motivate, train, or inspire your group, your staff, or some event, submit a request on my website. There's a tab at the top of the homepage that says Book Flora. Or you may email me directly at flora@florabrown.com. Now, on this radio show, Color Your Life Happy, we talk about the ways to create the lasting happiness you deserve in all areas of your life. To get at that goal, I interview guests each week from fields such as self-help, spiritual journeys, relationships, change and adversity, parenting, wealth creation, career, you name it, all of those things that contribute to our lasting happiness. Today's episode is The Role of Emotional Intelligence to Happiness with my guest, Dr. Izzy Justice. Now, Dr. Justice has over 2 decades of experience in the global management consulting business, working at Deloitte Consulting, Anderson Consulting, the global health care IT leader, Cerna Corporation. He sits on several for-profit and nonprofit boards. He's a sought-after advisor to several other boards and provides thought leadership on talent management and emotional intelligence in the workplace. Izzy is a certified Six Sigma Master Black Belt, and has authored 3 books. He has just completed his fourth book entitled E-Powerment, Achieving Empowerment in the E-World. He is fluent in 7 languages, has 2 Bachelor of Science degrees from Davidson College and North Carolina State University, an MBA from Queen's University, and a doctorate in emotional intelligence. It is my pleasure to welcome to the show today Dr. Izzy Justice. Hi there, Izzy.
Hi, Dr. Flora. How are you? Thank you so much for having me.
I am great. It is so wonderful to have you come on and help us with this so important issue. After I found out a little bit about what emotional intelligence is, I realized this is a very critical thing that we need to be working on in this world today. So why don't we just start off at the top talking about what it is. What is emotional intelligence, and why is it important to us?
Well, thank you. Again, thank you for having me on your show, and welcome to everybody that is listening. Excuse me. Well, you know, there are scientific definitions of what emotional intelligence is out there, and I find that most of them kind of go over people's heads, so I'll give you my sort of layman's view on emotional intelligence. If you think about human beings, you and I, and the things that invariably change in us from a minute to minute, an hour, a day-to-day perspective, there really is very little that changes. Our age doesn't change, our height doesn't change, our knowledge doesn't change, our IQ doesn't change. The only thing that really changes in us are our emotions, which is a result of the sort of varying and complex experiences that we have. It's the only sort of true variable that is a constant change in us. Our bodies, our physical bodies, are over 90% fluid. So we essentially are a chemical factory, if you would. And those chemicals that are in our factory are what emotions are. So emotional intelligence is recognizing what those chemicals are, the impact that they have on how we think, on how we behave, on how we perform, and quite frankly, all of the other tools that we use. Everything that we are starts with how we are feeling at that moment in time.
I like that you said we're a chemical factory. That just makes it very clear that we have all these chemicals going on, and these chemicals are, you're saying that these are our emotions, correct?
Exactly. I mean, they're not sort of just emotions. They're all kinds of liquids and that are in our body. But you know, people always argue with me that now wait a minute. I think thinking comes first. When I think something, then I will feel something. And and I always tell people, no, really, everything starts with your emotions. The example that I give people, Flora, is that I ask people to imagine that they're crossing a road. And suddenly, from the corner of their eye, they see a car coming at them. Well, that visual, that stimulus of the car coming at you, it goes through your eyes to the back of your brain. These very powerful chemicals are sort of instantly, in microseconds, released in your body. And without a single thought, most people jump, run, they just get the heck out of the way, right? So we are actually designed primitively for our emotions to come first and concurrently to shut down our cognitive functions, especially when stress levels are high. Because if you think about it, in the example of the car coming at us, if we had thought, if we had used our cognitive functions, it would have gone something like, well, what are my options over here? What if I do this? What if I do that? How fast is the car going? And clearly you are thinking, and clearly you would be hit. So
exactly.
You know, people always say, people say, well, what's the relevance of that? I don't have cars coming at me every day, and that's true. But working adults, we are very, especially as managers and leaders, professionals, adults, we are very protective of what we know, what we don't know, our roles, our titles, our standard of living. And when those get challenged in the same way that a car is coming at you and challenging you, threatening you, if you have poor emotional intelligence, then the same thing happens. We revert to this very Freudian or instinctive, I should say, fight or flight mode.
Right, right. Yeah, I was thinking about fight or flight when you were talking, because I remember studying that back in college as our natural, our native, our primitive reaction. And what you're saying is this is a good thing in some situations, but I imagine there are situations where we do want to think before we react, and we need to get control of the emotions. Not in the case of the car coming, but
absolutely,
in other
situations. Absolutely, yes, yes, and that is true. The point I'm trying to make is that in high stress situations, especially what I call when the emotional temperature of the situation is high, most of us really don't understand that we're essentially being held hostage by ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
The other example that I often give people is that I was coaching an executive of a company a few years ago, and we were getting ready to do this this pretty important presentation. His name was Tim. Tim was the CFO of the company. He literally had a Harvard MBA. And so I spent 2 weeks working with him on this presentation, and he was prepared. We did the Q&A. We did a dry run. I mean, name it. We had every I dotted, every T crossed, and we're ready to go. We get to the presentation, and it's going well for about 10, 15 minutes. And then what I call some live ammunition started to get fired, and questions started coming that he wasn't prepared for. And
mm-hmm.
he literally shut down. And I remember thinking about it at times, like, wait a minute, this guy had all the intelligence in the world. He was a good human being. He was a hard worker. He was a family man, good character. Everything was right, but something mm-hmm. clearly caused him to totally shut down and not say a word after those few comments were made.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a case of someone who, you know, his emotions got threatened, and they basically shut down his brain. So the brain is where all of our memory is. The memory to use the skills, the memory to use our knowledge, the memory to use what we have learned in the past. So emotions can shut them down, or in many cases, I should say, slow them down,
mm-hmm.
and therefore compromise the very things that we oftentimes spend our lives learning. But the problem with that is that we are learning them in a memory-based model. We are learning them so that we can recollect them at some future state, which means they're
mm-hmm.
in our memory banks, which means they're in our brains. But once that happens, you know, if you have poor EQ, you might as well, you know, not have access to them.
Hmm.
Does
so
that
in
make
other
sense?
Words, yes. So in other words, if a high stress situation comes or something we perceive as threatening for whatever reason, no matter how much knowledge we have in our brains, in our file cabinet, in our heads, we shut down. We don't have access to it.
Absolutely.
People forget their own names, or, you know, people can just forget basic stuff if they shut down.
Well, and there are physiological responses as well. You know, the hair on the back of our neck goes up. We begin to talk faster. Our palms begin to get sweaty. Our knees begin to shake. And sometimes it's not just one event. Sometimes it can be a cumulative set of events. I always tell people that, you know, the average negative experience that occurs. You know, so on one end of the spectrum, Flora, you could have something as simple as your pen doesn't work. It's not a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
You'll throw it in the trash and get a new pen, right?
Right.
On the
right.
other end of the spectrum of experiences, you could have, God forbid, somebody very important in your life pass away. So something
mm-hmm.
in the middle of those two. If that negative experience occurs in you, it is chemically in your body for an average of about 4 hours.
I think lost you for a minute. So when you come back, we'll pick up where we left off. I lost your audio. But I think you're comparing the things that happen to us between the lightweight experiences. You gave the example of the pen that doesn't work
right.
all the way to someone's death. And is that true? You know what I was thinking about, too? You gave the example of the pen that doesn't work, for
right.
example, correct?
Yeah.
Even though that's a minor event, I wonder sometimes in my own life if a series of minor things can build up. Because, you know, if you have a day where nothing seems to be working right, even though they're minor annoyances, can those also build up and be just as harmful as, you know, something big?
Absolutely. That, in fact, was the point I was trying to make, is that
mm-hmm.
we shouldn't take light of anything negative that occurs in our life. You know, I always ask people when I speak public, I say, you know, raise your hand if you wake up in the morning and you say, you know, I hope something negative happens to me today. Exactly. I usually get a good chuckle. No one wants, you know, bad things to happen to them when
sure.
they wake up in the morning. But then I say, raise your hand if invariably during the course of the day something negative happens. And
right.
everybody raises their hands. My
sure.
point is that we don't have a choice. It's life. Things will happen to us. The weather might not be right. Your pen might not work. You'll get that email from your daughter, your son, your relative, your boss, or you'll get a message here. Something will happen that will challenge you.
Right.
And what
right.
most of us do is that we ignore the emotional accumulation, cumulative impact of these negative experiences, and therefore we live in what I call an emotional hangover state. And honestly, I think most of us are in that state
mm-hmm.
where your body chemically is at a point where it cannot, you know, think freely. It cannot be purely collaborative. It cannot be open to exploring new ideas, new thoughts, because there's some element of it that is holding you on guard. And in some cases, these experiences might have happened when you were 5 or 6 years old.
Right.
In other
That's
cases,
what I was
it might
thinking.
Have happened this morning.
Right, right. Because I was thinking of the example you gave about the executive earlier.
Yes.
That the whatever happened in that audience, maybe somebody heckled or somebody asked a question that threatened him for some reason, that same question may not bother another person. But the
that
fact
is exactly
that it bothered
right.
him means that he has something going on. I don't know if it's childhood or whatever, that for him posed a threat. So it can be
exactly.
the same thing can affect us each differently, correct?
Exactly, exactly. And this is something that we call emotional resilience.
Okay.
Excuse me. Meaning
mm-hmm.
that, you know, some of us that go through, you know, tough experiences earlier in our life, we tend to be able to manage the progressive ones a little bit easier
mm.
and vice versa. Others that have had it a little bit easier in the beginning tend to have it a little bit harder, you know, in the future. And it really is true, because if you have it earlier in your life, you tend to be at an age where your emotions are raw, and therefore you tend to acknowledge them. I mean, I have children myself, and when my daughter is not happy, she literally will say, "Daddy, I'm sad."
Mm-hmm.
And when do you? How often do you hear adults say that? You know,
that's true. That's
exactly,
true.
And especially in the context of the workplace. In fact, if an adult were to say that, you'd like to be looked upon in some kind of a negative light.
Right,
you know, well,
right.
What is that person talking about? You know, but yet we all feel sad. We all feel happy. We all feel anxious. We all feel angry. We all feel frustrated. We all feel joyful. These emotions, you know, I always tell people to think of emotions as the weather. You know, they are. It is what it is. The worst thing you can do with your emotions is to ignore them or pretend that they aren't there. That's the worst
okay.
thing you can do. Now, you can do all kinds of things with them, but it certainly starts with you at least acknowledging what they are.
Okay. Now, you mentioned emotional intelligence and gave us a good definition of it. Are there some components to it that we need
yes.
to know about that will help us understand it better?
Absolutely, absolutely. If you think about emotions, so there are some dimensions that have to do with you and you. You yourself are a chemical factory. So, your self-awareness is one dimension that really is a skill, and you can learn how to do this. You can learn how to be more self-aware of what you are feeling constantly. And one way of doing that, I often tell people, is to, you know, pick a time of the day, any time, 3 o'clock in the morning, 10 o'clock at night, 12 o'clock at noon. Pick any time of the day, but one time, and take your emotional temperature. And simply ask yourself, what am I feeling right now? Am I feeling this? Am I feeling that? And there are a spectrum of sort of emotional labels out there, but, you know, start to give yourself a label. Start to give your emotions a label. Now, self-regulation, which is the second internal dimension, is, okay, well, if this is how I feel, and what I feel is not the right place to be for the situation at hand, how can I regulate it so that I can get back on track?
Mm-hmm.
If I have a very important call, say at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and 15 minutes before that call, I get a really nasty email.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't care who you are, you better do something before 2 o'clock, right? Because this email has really upset you. Your chemical composition has changed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, most of us will ignore it, and then we'll go to the 2 o'clock call, and it's not going to go well. Or it won't go nearly as well as it could have.
Exactly.
Now, so self-regulation is, okay, I'm angry, I'm frustrated. Now, what are 3 or 4 or 5 things that I can do to, you know, regulate my chemical composition? I keep going to the chemical factory
mm-hmm.
analogy here. And there are all kinds of things you can do from, you know, breathing. You can breathe very, 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 very slowly. I always tell people to take a long count in and a long count out. And at a
mm-hmm.
minimum, what that does, it reduces your heart rate. It gets the blood circulating. It increases the capacity of your bronchi. And by the way, constriction of the bronchi, your lungs basically, is one of the symptoms of when your emotional temperature has gone up. And this is why if you look at people that are very, very nervous, they're kind of breathing very fast and they're kind of talking like this, you know, because they're running out of oxygen. And then the third and last piece of sort of this internal relationship that you have with you, self-awareness, self-regulation, is motivation. A lot of people
mm-hmm.
think that motivation is a behavior. It actually is not. It's an emotion. You feel like you want to wake up in the morning, and you feel like you can do anything, and you feel like you're worthy of greatness. These are feelings that then allow you to exhibit behaviors such as excitement or, you know, very action-oriented kinds of things. And emotions, they are transient, meaning that they come and they go. They're never a constant. So
mm-hmm.
all these things, to be able to monitor them, to regulate them, and to be aware of where your motivation is really key. The other half of it is the relationship that you have with other chemical factories. That would be other human beings, because they're human. They
mm-hmm.
have their own chemicals too. And
right.
so, if I can, in self-awareness, if I can measure it for myself, would it be powerful for me to be able to measure it in others?
Mm-hmm.
And in some cases, it's very easy. If someone is crying in front of you, that's a signal. That means that something's wrong. Something sad has happened. But in most
yeah.
cases, especially in the workplace, it's not that black and white. It's not that obvious.
Right.
You know? And so there are clues that human being gives with their behaviors and their nonverbals and even their verbals that allow you insight into where they are chemically, emotionally. Most of us try to get into other people's mind, which I think is a waste
mm-hmm.
of time. getting into, well, because the mind is infinitely more complex, and you
right.
never know what people are actually thinking, but
right.
you can always tell how they're feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And really, for the purposes of you engaging with them so that you can have a good outcome, whatever that might be, maybe it's a conversation with your spouse or your child, or maybe it's you know, a business meeting that you're having, at the end game is the outcome is a successful one. You
mm-hmm.
and him and her, whatever it is, you had a pleasant conversation, you interacted, and it led to something good as opposed to something bad.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, salespeople. I find salespeople, they'll be selling something to someone, and their nonverbals are basically telling them that they're afraid.
Mm-hmm.
And what they then try to do is to throw more benefits of whatever or the value proposition of what they're selling, and it exacerbates their fear. Instead, if they had taken the emotional temperature and said, this person is actually afraid of what I'm saying, what can I say or do to bring the fear down so that they can actually listen to what I have to say?
Because
when people are afraid in a fear mode, again, the brain shuts down, so you're actually not even listening to you can hear the
right.
words. But they're not going into the interpretation factory.
Right, okay. So one of the clues then that you mentioned, some of the clues are not so obvious in our interactions. So crying, for example, you gave, that's a very overt and obvious clue.
Yes.
But there are a bunch of nonverbal clues that I would imagine is to our benefit to learn to recognize. And you gave the example of the salesperson. So what would be an example of a nonverbal clue that a salesman perhaps might notice? You're talking about when they're working with a potential client, correct?
Yeah. absolutely. I mean,
what
all
might
kinds
be
of
a nonverbal?
Yeah, maybe they're not looking at you in the eye. You know, maybe
okay.
they're looking down. Maybe they're playing with their nails. And this is where behavioral work can be very helpful. You know, all the
mm-hmm.
behavioral instruments that are out there, such as DISC, for example. You know, I think behavior is the window to emotions.
Okay.
I don't think behavior is the end-all, be-all, because they're simply manifesting what your emotions are.
Mm-hmm.
Now, yes, all of us have a preferred style. There's some people that like a lot of detail. There's some people that hate a lot of detail. They want things more abstract. There's some people that are much more amiable and avoid conflict. So whatever the style is, I think that comes secondary to what the emotion is.
Mm-hmm.
Because
okay.
all those styles, whether using Myers-Briggs or DISC, whatever it is, all the styles, what they have in common are their emotions.
Mm-hmm.
So you're much likely to, you know, if you knew what nonverbals went with what emotions, you know, if
mm-hmm.
someone is smiling at you and they're looking you straight in the eye and they're nodding their head, these are clues. These are nonverbal clues that are saying the person is paying attention to me. They feel safe.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Right? Because who
yeah.
feels threatened and smiles? Nobody does.
Right.
You know what I mean? So
yes,
a lot of emotional intelligence, some people say, well, gosh, this is common sense. Well, yes, it is common sense, but it's a new science.
Right, right. I wanted to go back to the first, when you first started talking about these components, the self-awareness, for example. When you said pick a time of day, is it helpful for us to pick a time of day each day? I mean, let's say 12 noon every day to kind of check in with ourselves at that point?
Yes. I often tell people
okay.
to take their mobile device and just set an alarm. Just
okay.
give yourself a little buzz and say, okay, no matter where you are, you may be in a restaurant, you may be in your office, you may be on a conference call, you may be in the bathroom, wherever
okay.
you are at that specific time. You know, and it only takes, and no one has to know. You can just ask
sure.
yourself, how am I feeling?
Right.
And okay. sometimes you can even do a little body scan. You know, just imagine that there's a laser light on top of your head and it's going all the way down to your toes.
Mm-hmm.
And just
mm-hmm.
says, you know, are my shoulders okay? Is my neck fine? Are my hips okay? Are my knees? You know, you can do a sort of full body scan of yourself
mm-hmm.
and figure
mm-hmm.
out, you know, if your body is in tension. And again,
mm.
if your body is in tension, that means that your brain is also in tension, and it's not going to be used fully.
Hmm. That makes me think about the fact that the emotions may be lodged in a certain part of our bodies. As you just gave the example of scanning your body, you may
yeah.
discover, let's say, a knot in your stomach or something of
yeah.
that nature. And knowing that, then can help you with the next step, you said, with self-regulation. And
yeah.
then maybe we discover a pattern, I would think, over time. We may discover that every day at 12 noon we have a knot in our stomach or whatever the particular
right.
thing we discover. Is that true, that we can discover
it absolutely is true. The knot in the stomach is more of a metaphor. The stomach is never in a knot, but if
no,
you think about
true.
Yeah, if you think about you know, our neck and our shoulders, which is really, if you, from a biological perspective, the top of our spinal cord starts at the bottom of our skull,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
that's where the amygdala rests. Amygdala is a small gland which is responsible for releasing the hormones that allow you to respond in these stressful times. And therefore, at that point, below the cranium, around the neck area, and the shoulders is where people tend to feel a lot of stress, if you think about
mm-hmm.
it, because that's where these things
yeah.
are actually coming from.
Right.
But happiness, if you go back to the theme of your show,
mm-hmm.
you know, happiness is an emotional state.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not a constant state. You know, I'm always wary of people that say, I'm really happy and I've been happy for the last 10 years. Because it just can't be true. You need sadness to be happy. If you didn't have sadness, how would you know that you're happy?
Exactly, right.
So
to me,
I am more enamored with, and I applaud people more who say things like, I am constantly aware of my emotions. To me, that's a more realistic sign of what happiness is than someone
mm-hmm.
saying, I am happy.
Mm-hmm.
Because
mm-hmm.
happiness is not is not an amputation of all other negative emotions.
Right.
To the contrary, it's using them in a manner that allows you to have a positive outcome.
Right. I'm very happy you were pointing this out, because one of the things that happened when I came out with my book is some people got a little intimidated and thought that I was promoting this constant state of happiness, when in fact happiness is knowing what to do, knowing about self-regulation and being able to regulate your life as life happens to you. As you said, every day we're going to encounter ups and downs,
right,
and things we have absolutely no control over that are outside,
right,
of ourselves. But
right,
we do have control of the inside of ourselves, and that's what you're getting at, correct?
Absolutely, absolutely. We can control what we are thinking about by, first of all, acknowledging what the emotions are. You know, if you're sad, you can say, I feel sad right now. And there are times when you may, quite deservedly so, need to feel sad. You know, if someone important in your life has passed away, it is very normal to feel sad. The expectation is not that you become happy when someone important to you passes away.
Right.
In fact,
right,
I often tell people that grieving is, to me, it's just one of those lost emotions, yet it's one of the most powerful times when people are grieving, you know, over anything. Someone has passed away, someone has left you. You know, grieving to me is a, it's a wonderful and almost incomparable heightened state of awareness. When people are grieving, they're asking themselves some really powerful questions. Why am I here? What did I do? Am I doing the right things? And the kind of clarity that comes during the grieving process to not just the questions but the answers to those questions, you can't make up. You can't buy enough
right,
time from a psychologist to create that sense of grief so that you can ask yourself those questions. My point is that all these emotions, the entire spectrum of them, makes us who we are, and feeling them all is part of being human. It's part of what makes us such powerful creatures, and ultimately part of being happy. Happiness is not
right,
just about feeling good all the time or having the perfect body. Or to me, it's more about embracing the spectrum of emotions collectively, both yours and the most equally as important, those are the ones that you really care about.
Right. That is wonderful. I'm so happy that you pointed out that grieving brings clarity, because I think if someone tried to suppress their grief and tried to put on a happy face, that they would end up doing more damage to themselves in the long run, because whatever they're grieving or need to grieve over is still there. If they don't deal with it, then they are not getting, as you pointed out, the clarity that they need, and they're not working
right,
through and processing through it. So it sounds like it could be damaging to not feel those emotions and work through them, correct?
Yes, and that's what leads to those hangovers that I was telling you about. If you think of a physiological hangover, say people that I don't know, maybe this past weekend on Friday night you just drank a little too much, and the next day you're hungover. How are you when you're hungover? You're tired, you're thirsty, you got a headache, you can't think very clearly, you just want to rest, you don't want to hear any loud noises, you know. And it's the same thing with an emotional hangover. Only emotional hangovers aren't visible to others. But we have experiences, emotions that we feel that we've just sort of, you know, pushed them away and locked them up in some closet somewhere and refused to acknowledge them and refused to process them and refused to use them. And so we end up being in a state like that client of mine, where at some random moment, you know, one person says something in a certain way that just unleashes, you know, the power of that hangover and causes us to freeze.
Wow.
And to me, that's a freezing is one outcome, but the alternative is you can get a machine gun and start shooting people, too.
Exactly. That's what I was thinking. The alternative is exploding and harming people who have nothing to do with whatever triggered you in the first place. I mean, whatever brought it on is so far back and so far removed from the situation. That's the scary one to me.
Yeah. I always tell people to, you know, in your day, in your Rolodex of friends that you have in Facebook or LinkedIn or whatever you use, you know, I am sure there are people that everyone has in their lives that are people that are just themselves. They, when they're sad, they tell you they're honest, they're authentic. They tell you, hey, I'm not feeling too good right now. When they're happy, they tell you why. I think things like that are very contagious.
Mm-hmm.
And so I encourage, you know, another way of learning emotional intelligence is to surround yourself with people that have high emotional intelligence. Maybe not formally, you know, they haven't been assessed and they don't have a score. But they're there. You know, our grandparents are like that, for example. They've been through everything. They don't care about how something is interpreted. They just call it like it is. And when they're sad, they say, oh, baby, I'm sad today. And if they're happy, they say, oh, I'm so happy to see you, you know. That's why we love grandparents, and that's why the elderly, because they're at a point where they don't care. You know, their guard is on top.
Yeah,
and so if we surround ourselves with people like that, just by osmosis, just by being around them, you know, we can learn and we can observe and become much more emotionally competent. And ultimately, the goal here is, again, it's not so much happiness per se. You know, one of my, I think, I'm not quite sure who it was actually, to be honest with you, but there's a great saying about happiness. It says that it cannot be pursued directly. It's the consequence of an activity.
Right.
You're always doing something, the result of which is that you're happy, right?
Right, exactly.
And so this state of being emotionally aware, emotionally competent of yourself, of others, in my opinion, is what that activity is that ultimately leads you to be happy, to be serene, to be able to fully collaborate and share your ideas with your spouse at home, with others, to avoid rancor and conflict and free yourself, really, ultimately.
Wow. It sounds like there are probably people who can benefit, and probably all of us, from having some guidance in this area, because I don't think most of us were brought up, and certainly not trained in school, to go through these components. So how can people reach you if they are now listening to this and thinking, wow, I want to get coached or I want to get some help in becoming more aware and learning techniques for regulating myself? How can they reach you?
Well, thank you for asking. Our website is www.eqmentor.com. That's EQMENTOR.com. Look us up. My contact information is on that website. We have a model that matches anybody anywhere in the world with someone who is their mentor. Historically, if you think about formal ways of learning, institutional learning, as I call it, classroom learning, formal learning is only about 150 to about a 200-year-old concept. But prior to then, the way that human beings learned and grew and mature was always from other people.
Right.
It's actually, mentoring is actually the oldest modality and the most powerful one that human beings have used since the advent of time to learn, to grow, and to be very successful and happy. And so, with the internet now, we have recreated that same modality by, matching mentors from all over the world with mentees from all over the world, and they can engage with each other online in a very safe environment. They can be vulnerable. They can expose themselves in their own private rooms and build their emotional competency, their emotional intelligence, and resilience, and learn to get out of that hangover stage.
Well, I'm so happy you mentioned all over the world, because when people go to your site, www.eqmentor.com, they can come from any place in the world, but you'll be able to match them with one of your mentors that will be conveniently located. But you mentioned online, so actually people will be working with their mentors online or on the phone?
Yeah, online. It's all done online, and it doesn't matter. Geography, excuse me. In May of this year, 2010, HBR, we were in Harvard Business Review, and the mentor there was from Connecticut, USA, and the mentee was from New Zealand. Mm-hmm. And those two people would have never met each other or known each other and known that, oh, my God, you know, my style of communication, my style of learning, my background, excuse me, is exactly, you know, the right model for the other person.
Mm-hmm. That's what I love about the Internet. It has made it possible for us to reach across the world without regard for geography, as you said. And it's just amazing what we can do. And I believe eventually this is how world peace is going to be brought about, because we will be interacting with people from around the world. And it removes that fear of other people. It increases diversity. It's just, I think, a wonderful thing that we have access to.
Well, what it has done, you know, people always think about the Internet and it's eliminated geographical barriers. But to me, the one thing that it has done more than any other thing that has fundamentally changed the way that we live and interact and work with each other is this concept called the mobility of knowledge. It used to be that if you ever wanted to learn something or to know something, you went there. And that there could be a library, a school, a college, another place, a learning center, a conference. It was always some place where you went to get what you wanted. Mm-hmm. And what the Internet and the mobile devices have done, and laptops and all those kinds of things, is that they have eliminated the there, so that the knowledge is mobile and it is wherever you are. So you could be on your beach house, you could be in a remote mountain, you could be in downtown Manhattan. You could be wherever you are, so long as you have access to the Internet. You don't have to go anywhere. I mean, people are getting degrees online right now. You are, and
exactly.
They're incredibly competent people here.
Yes, that's a wonderful point you're making. And I'm a good example of that, because I do teach an online class, and it's university students, graduate students, and they're from all over. And it's just wonderful to be able to interact with them without having to be concerned about where they're from. As a matter of fact, many times with my radio guests, I forget, or maybe not even know, where they are located physically, because we are able to get together here without being concerned about that.
Right.
I want to give you an opportunity to, we have 2 minutes left on the interview. I want to give you an opportunity to share any closing words with us, or success story, whatever you like. But most important, I want to stress to listeners the importance of not ignoring your emotional state. I think this is something you said that is critical, to not make light of it, to do something about it if you're discovering that your emotions are not well regulated. So what closing words could you share with us about this?
Well, I'll share with you a story, and I'll do this very, very quickly. Is I have a really dear mentor of mine who passed away in 1989, and he died of a terminal illness, so I knew that he was dying. His name is Gary Mason, and he was in New Orleans in 1989, and I was a young, you know, college student, poor and broke, and the only way that I could communicate with him was via the phone.
Mm-hmm.
And if you recall, and I'm going to share my age now, but if you waited until 10 or 11 o'clock those days, the rates went down.
Right.
And so I would oftentimes call him at 10 or 11 o'clock at night, and we would talk. Every conversation that we had was 2 or 3 hours long. And one of the conversations that I had right before he died, and I obviously didn't know that he was going to die, you know, at the end of it, because I was always sending him something. I was sending him a T-shirt, an article, you know, a hat, or something to kind of cheer him up. At the end of this last conversation, one of the last conversations that I had with Gary, he said to me, thank you for the gift. And, you know, Flora, I hadn't sent him anything in about 2 or 3 weeks, so I didn't want to take credit for, you know, something that someone else had sent him. So I said, Gary, I didn't do it. I didn't send you anything, so I don't want to take credit for the gift. And he says, oh, no, I'm not, you know, I'm talking about the gift of this conversation.
Wow.
And I said, oh, I never thought of a conversation as a gift. And he said to me, you know, all these things that I have, I'm about 100% sure I'm not going to take them with me. But I got a feeling I'll take these conversations with me. And those conversations that I had with him right before he died, probably about 3 months, were some of the most powerful, some of the most pure, some of the most authentic conversations. And I often tell people that, you know, please don't wait for someone important in your life to be close to death to have those really good conversations with them. But it takes a lot of emotional intelligence. It takes a state of self-awareness, of self-regulation, of empathy towards others to recognize who the people are that you can have those conversations with, what the right time is to have those conversations. And trust me, they're very powerful, they're life-changing, and they give you a source of sort of joy and confidence that you take for the rest of your life in some cases, just as, you know, the opposite, where there's some experiences that keep you down for the rest of your life. So emotional intelligence allows you to have those conversations with people, like the one I had with my Gary, although, you know, and by the way, I've had them with other people since, but they're not dying.
Right. And so your point is to have those conversations, those uplifting conversations with authentic people right now. Don't wait for some kind of death sentence to be pronounced. Just do it now, because it's probably the most valuable gift we could ever give or share with someone, because the giver and the receiver both are being gifted. That's what's so great about what you're sharing. I want to thank you so much, Dr. Izzy, for coming on today.
My pleasure.
And I want to invite my listeners to tune in again next Monday, November 1st, 2010, at 11 a.m. for another inspiring and exciting show. We have benefited so much from this. I know I have. And I'm going to encourage listeners who feel the call to use your coaching service, who have heard the benefit here, to be sure to go to www.eqmentor.com. Thank you, everyone. Have a blessed week. Tune in and join us again next week. In the meantime, you know what I'm going to ask you to do, and that is to color your life happy this week.
Color your life happy.
Color.
Color your life happy.com.